So, hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And we've entitled this one, What's Next for the RBA? So, they've stepped out of their two-year lockstep in reducing rates for the first time in quite a while this month, in this month's meeting. And so we thought now's probably not a bad time to reflect upon what sort of got us there and certainly look to the future. I'm joined today in a slight little change-up in the room. So, we'll start with our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And our Head of Strategy, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
Hi, Tim.
Very good. So let's roll into the agenda or the content for today. So we're going to be looking at the RBA hanging a U-turn in some Australian parlance there for anyone listening from overseas. Our thoughts are still not dovish enough. Of course, then what will it do next? And then, as always, round out with the investment implications and the way that we use these themes every day at the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth. We will be keeping an eye, as always, on the questions if you are listening in live. So please feel free to drop in some questions there. And we do have some carryover champion questions from last week as well, which we'll be feeding in. So I'd like to move into our first slide. What's next for the RBA? Who'd like to begin?
I'll kick us off.
Good on you, David.
Thanks, Tim. So a couple of slides here from the recent statement on monetary policy from the RBA. Excuse me, frog in the throat. And this statement was the pivotal moment in the RBA's ongoing U-turn, where it put out some new forecasts that delayed the rise in inflation and also any fall in unemployment.
Actually, can I jump in quickly, David?
Yeah.
I think there's. Sorry. I think to put some back history into it, the RBA has been forecasting a sudden turnaround for a long time. So what's been happening is since. So where are we now on that? You can see on this graph that inflation, the trimmed mean inflation, which is meant to be between 2% and 3%. So we can from 2010 to 2015, it was between 2% and 3%, but sort of towards the lower end of it. And around about 2015, it fell out of that range, and it's been out of that range ever since. And they've been forecasting an imminent return to that range for the last 4 or 5 years. So the issue is that they've finally got around to the point of saying, and I think that's where we've been sort of pushing against that for a while. And so I think and the market has come around to that view very much so in the last little while. And so the RBA has been, that whole period of the RBA has been talking about we're gonna raise rates, and now they've finally come to a couple of months ago they finally come to the conclusion now they need to cut rates, and then in the most recent one that they have actually cut rates. The issue is that 25 basis points cut usually takes about any rate cut usually takes 12 to 18 months to actually flow through to the economy. So we're talking a while before you get to anywhere. 25 basis points isn't very much, and you do need, especially since rates have fallen so low, we're going to need more of them to actually make an effect on the economy. So the key part David's trying to get to with this graph, though, is that now they've actually finally extended the period, so we can still see inflation bouncing back into its range, but taking 3 or 4 years to get there and extending out that time frame, which sort of gives them now the latitude to actually get out and cut rates, because they kept on forecasting an imminent turnaround. It's pretty hard to have forecasted this imminent turnaround, then have to cut rates.
Go against your own forecasts.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
there's one point to add as well to that, and these charts presuppose a cash rate of 1%. That was buried in the detail of the statement. So they've already assumed cutting rates to 1%, two more cuts, or another 25 basis points, as well as the recent cut. And even with that, as you can see on their own forecasts, they take several years to barely flop back into the 2% to 3% inflation range, and the unemployment rate, barely budges for years and eventually kind of grinds down. So that takes us forward to the next chart. So, in other words, the RBA has given the game away, in a sense, in these forecasts, because it's saying we're planning on cutting to 1%, and even so, we're not going to meet our own mandate. So, they're already indicating they'll have to go below 1. So, if you move over to the next chart, this is all part of the RBA's big kind of intellectual reappraisal of how Damo described it, getting it very wrong over the last few years. This is, basically what's called the Nauru, and it for many years has assumed that...
So let's just... The Nauru is that the point at which you have an unemployment rate where it doesn't increase inflation.
Yeah. Mm. And so it's been working on the assumption of that 5% would be that number. 5% unemployment would, anything at or below that would start to generate inflation, and obviously the economy simply has not, delivered on that model.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now reappraised this Nauru, and it's currently seeing it as below 4.5% unemployment suddenly, which will generate inflation. So, now it needs, therefore, to ease to get to this level of unemployment so that it can generate its inflation mandate. So if you want to...
And just putting that into context as well. So the US at the moment has unemployment of pretty close to 3.5%. So and no massive signs of any inflation breakout, in the US. So you're starting to see you're seeing a few tentative signs of some wage growth, but it's still pretty minor. So we've been talking, and I think the theme for us is that the RBA has been behind the curve, and there's certainly some areas where they've turned around and improving, but we're looking at other advanced economies. Germany's got extremely low unemployment rate and no inflation to speak of. And so I guess where we're getting to is, well, that estimate may not be falling fast enough either. So we could quite easily be at 4.5%. Well, the US is at 3.5%, and no signs of an inflation outbreak. And so the reasoning why Australia should be so much higher is
not apparent.
Mm. No. Very good.
So if we flip over, we can sort of summarise those things. It's basically already forecasting a 1% cash rate and below, implied by its own forecasts. It's revising down its entire intellectual framework for what it's got to do to lift inflation and forecasting it or rounding it down in a way that means more rate cuts. Felix curve is just another way of kind of conceptualizing the Nauru, which is the relationship between the level of unemployment and wages growth. And it's more or less thrown that out here, or at least redefining it. And so the implication of this is you won't need to see job losses for further rate cuts. You could actually see stable unemployment and the RBA having to keep cutting.
Right.
So it's changed what economists call the RBA reaction function for cutting interest rates.
Okay.
Or raising, for that matter. So if you want to flip over to the next section, so we've got the RBA doing this U-turn, and it's, probably, as Damo suggested, a decade late, didn't learn from other central banks and economies, but it is doing it as, sort of fast as the RBA can manage, which is slow. And so it's still not dovish enough in our view, principally because the economy is in such a bog at the moment that unemployment is very likely to rise rather than fall in the RBA's, which is in the RBA's current forecasts. So we've just got a couple of charts here. First is ANZ job ads, which clearly, have fallen off a little mini cliff going into the federal election. There's a few issues around some of the sampling vis-a-vis the election, etc. in this chart, but the trend is what you need to look at, and it's very clearly down for job ads.
And having said that, we think it's not going to improve. We think it's probably stabilise post election. But the confidence in where this is going is relatively low at the moment from our perspective, in terms of saying, I think there has been a decent change amongst the, what do you call it, real estate agents and the property brokers are obviously a lot happier now than what they were pre-election. And so, yeah, there may be a change in this to stabilise it a bit. But it does seem to us that given your approvals, the length of time for property approvals, and we're already on this big downtrend in that, it seems pretty hard to see a sudden bounce back in this. And it's, you know, if you got a stabilisation, I think it'd be a pretty good outcome. But
yeah,
but it could go either way.
Okay.
So flip to the next chart, and this is the NAB Business Survey, which is a very good leading indicator for the macroeconomy in Australia. And the blue line is the one you want to focus on here, which is capacity utilisation, and it's inverted in this chart. So in other words, capacity utilisation is falling in the Australian economy, and you know that means obviously that businesses are more likely than not to be shedding staff than adding them, and so
what capacity utilization means is that it's an approximate measure how much, you know, if you've got a factory, how much your factory is actually working. So if you're at whatever we are, 81% at the moment, then you need the And you're shrinking, you don't need to go and buy a new factory. Mm. Whereas the higher that goes, then you start getting people going, okay, well, I'm reaching capacity in this one and I need to start putting more investment. So falling, capacity utilization is usually a bad thing for capital expenditure going forward.
And so what sectors does that cover? Is that
the entire economy.
That's the economy. Chart. Okay. Yeah. That'd be an interesting one to measure.
So you can see...
It's very approximate. Approximate.
Yeah. But you can see on the chart that the blue line is a leading indicator for the black line being unemployment.
Mm.
So the big turn we've seen in capacity utilisation falling, you know, will lead to higher unemployment, basically, is what that chart is saying. Okay, so if we flip to the next chart, we can summarise our view on unemployment, or just flip through the economy briefly and give you, you know, an idea of why we think there is no imminent rebound. I mean, there's enough kind of stagnation already for unemployment to begin rising. We've just had the number for May, which obviously is a bit compromised by, labour force number from the ABS today, which will be a bit compromised by the election. But, you know, under the bonnet, it showed quite a bit of weakness with underemployment trending up.
And coming back to, you know, one of our key takes and, certainly probably more good, hat tip to Leith for this, but he writes blogs a lot on this topic, but is that unemployment is not as important as what underemployment is, and that if we're seeing underemployment rising, then that's actually the more dangerous sign for the economy in terms of wages and economic growth going forward.
Yeah.
Because that's where and especially with some of the gig economy we're talking about, the
and domestic demand,
yeah.
And inflation tends to track those, yeah, the wages growth as well. So, yeah.
But because I guess as you're saying, David, just earlier, you know, anyone can be an Uber driver at the moment. So, mm-hmm, you know, you work a few hours of Uber driving a week, and
you're employed,
and you're no longer unemployed.
Yeah.
But you know, if you have a degree and you're trying to get back into the workforce, then you wouldn't class yourself as you'd definitely put yourself in the underemployed.
Mm.
You actually want the full time role and stuff like that.
Yep, that's a good point. Yep.
So the basic problem is there are no real growth drivers to prevent a rise in underemployment, most certainly, and probably unemployment as well. The fiscal impulse is quite large at the moment, but expanding it from here is going to be difficult because the housing bust is really constrained state governments.
And what David meant by fiscal impulse is basically how much is the government actually spending on projects, CapEx projects and things like that, in terms of, you know, can they actually grow the economy? And so you've obviously heard a lot of talk in the elections about this big run-up in infrastructure spending.
Mm.
The result is we're actually already at points where we're already spending a lot on infrastructure. NBN is fading off, so that's sort of a negative on that front. There's a bit of a hole before you get to some of these later ones, and even you know, you go out and announce a new roadway tomorrow, you're not actually out there spending serious amounts of money for years. And so there's a bit of a, when David says that, you know, it's constrained, you know, even if today, you know, today there was a sudden a big, you know, $100 billion infrastructure deal pushed through Parliament, you're still talking about a year or two at least before you start really seeing the effect of that.
Okay. Yep. Fair enough.
So we do have tax cuts coming that are roughly about 0.5% of GDP, but in this environment, and not, you know, there isn't as much likely to get saved as they are spent, and there's sort of some issues about how they're going to get passed in the short term as well. So, I mean, that fiscal stimulus just won't be huge. I mean, the other constraint, of course, is the whole political culture in Australia, where the federal government, the recently elected federal government, has committed itself to a surplus, so it's difficult for it to commit itself to a surplus that we didn't even get to yet, even though it said we had, and so it's a bit painted into a corner on that. So the other growth drivers that are still difficult, the housing market is still troubled. And the key for that, obviously, is consumption will be still weakish, even as prices stabilise. And perhaps more importantly is housing investment, so building homes and dwellings, apartments, etc. There's still a good 18 months of falling activity baked in for that, just based on the recent bust. So that will be a headwind, not just stable, but an actual headwind. Business investment has been weak, and it's unlikely to suddenly run away because domestic demand is weak based around these other things. And so the only real driver we've seen in the last 12 months has been government spending, which is doing its darndest and has more or less been responsible for all the employment growth that we've seen, but it's simply not enough. And then into that weak kind of domestic demand scenario, you have a mass immigration flood that, you know, is a permanent labour supply shock, which means just there's always more people for fewer jobs or not enough jobs.
Yep.
And so wages, you know, just don't rise. And if you get this extra labour market weakness on top of that, then wages growth is probably going to actually fall away for the next 12 months.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I've got a quick one here. Questions come in. I'll throw it out to the table. So Lindsay David was speculating yesterday that if Westpac's resi mortgage, Westpac's loan resi mortgage book is mid-70s, not sure if mid-70 LVR, is it? And its business loan book might all or mostly be secured against property, then what is the implication of that? Do you guys think that Westpac is headed for the chopping block if it doesn't turn around? And do you think zero rates in QE will be enough to turn this thing around?
Okay, well, we'll get to zero interest rates and QE in a moment.
Sure.
I mean, you're seeing the mad scramble for stimulus in the RBA and APRA, by and large, because I think they've realised that they're close to a tipping point for the banks. You know, picking out individual banks and where that tipping point is extremely difficult to do. All I can say is that at a certain point, when collateral values fall enough, then those LVRs start to rise and they need to raise capital. And at that point, you're looking at a possible credit crunch. That's not our base case, simply because, you know, the cavalry has arrived, if you like, but you can't discount it as a tail risk, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess to put that into my perspective, my sort of framing of that is that there's certainly a very real risk that there's so much of the banks, the banks in Australia have a lot in residential mortgages to start with, plus a lot of their business lending is all being backed by residential mortgages. So, and so they are very, very exposed. What, as David said, you know, it's recognised, and I think that's part of the reason why we have all these, you know, there's all APRA sort of a couple of months after being slammed in a Royal Commission for doing too much for the banks, it's turning around and doing as much as it can to ease things for the banks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's recognition that from the central banks and APRA and things like that they need to try and keep the housing market afloat in order to, because otherwise the banks have got problems.
Yep.
The thing is, when you see housing crashes around the world, though, you can't say those housing crashes happened because the central authorities didn't care. You know, in most cases, they all wanted the same thing. They wanted to keep this housing boom going on for as long as possible, but sort of hit a point, and as David called it, the tipping point, where once you go past that point, doesn't really matter, you know, what the central authorities do if your housing market started to crash and everyone takes a big step back and you're throwing all these, you know, we can lend 95% of the value, or we'll lend you 100% of the value. Like, if people aren't borrowing, it doesn't make any difference.
Yep, yep.
And so I guess where we're coming to from this is, yes, this is a very real tail risk, and it's probably the biggest tail risk you need to keep in mind. It's not the base case, but, you know, it's a very real risk that when you look at your portfolio, you need to say, well, even if you've got a 10 or 20% chance of that happening, it's quite a catastrophic downside, and the upside is nowhere near as much just given the levels of debt and how expensive houses already are, that there's a base case is a grind lower, but there's this big tail risk sitting there that you can't ignore.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Good answer. And thanks for that question, dear listener, Haptic. We'll jump across now to looking at what the RBA will potentially do next, David.
Okay. So, well, I mean, all that boils down to what we think will be another three rate cuts on top of the one we've already had. And I don't think that the RBA will go below 50 basis points. I think that will be the bottom for the cash rate.
Why is that? Just out of interest?
Because it wants to preserve some what is called spread, the interest rate difference between the funding costs for the banks and what they get, or what they charge for mortgages. Mm-hmm. And once you get to zero, that really gets squashed.
Yep.
And it hammers bank profitability.
Yep. Okay.
And so you can get yourself into a pickle over a credit crunch by doing that as well.
Yep.
So if the RBA leaves it at 50 basis points, it's a bit easier for the banks to earn. So we think they'll do that. Look, there might be more apricots as well, but either way, we think that they'll move too slowly.
Mm.
Despite this big U-turn, you know, they're a radically conservative bunch. And our
take was U-turn should have been a couple of years ago.
It should have been, absolutely. Yeah. It should have been a couple of years ago and should have been much more sharp. And, you know, they're in slow motion still here. So despite the turnaround, it won't be enough. And they'll because they're doing things that they haven't done before, like easing in APRA and what have you, they'll probably want to wait and see what each one does before they go ahead with the cash rate.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than pile in and really just get things moving.
Well, do you think it will take a new governor, like it does sort of with the Fed, the way the new governor sort of sets the tone of the next...
Phil Lowe's got another, 3 years?
Yeah.
Four years?
Yeah.
But we saw, though, the US Fed turn around pretty quickly once the markets pushed in, you know, It was our December. The December push was, you know, the Fed governor there was Powell was talking about saying, well, we're a long way from normal, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was like, oh, well, actually, maybe we're not. maybe we're there.
Yep.
Our base case is that that getting the cash rate down to 50 basis points, you know, will probably be enough just to get stabilization, maybe grind higher in house prices, you know, but not enough to inject any real kind of vitality into domestic demand, which then, you know, poses a very prickly question of what they do next. You know, they'll have a little fiscal support and maybe a little bit of support from households, but just not enough still. And, you know, so if we get to, you know, mid next year and unemployment is higher than it is today and wages are still really growing very slowly and it's still a very troubled and difficult economy, then, you know, where does the RBA go? This is a really difficult question for them because, again, they are so conservative. And so, you know, what other banks, central banks have done, of course, is moved to unconventional policy tools.
Yep.
So that's quantitative easing and there's a whole suite of those, anything from kind of forward guidance right through to printing money and buying assets. But the RBA is, you know, likely to be loath to want to go there. And I'm not sure it could even get there based on domestic weakness alone. Like I fear that they would really want to wait until they got some kind of external shock that really forces their hand.
Right.
I guess if we get to mid next year and we're got a really sluggish economy, they'll have to consider these things without crisis. But, you know, they really are very, very slow to embrace these things. So I'm, you know, I'm not sure that they will go without things getting worse
yep.
first. So, if you want to flip over the next slide, we could examine what that will look like, because it will come one way or another. Australian household debt has simply gone too far, and there's no getting out of it with having to go this way. So what will QE look like? I mean, there's a few obvious things that the RBA will do. They're doing some of them already through their repo markets, and they buy or they fund RMBS through liquidity operations, and those are mortgage bonds that the banks create and use to fund mortgages. So they'll certainly probably wade into that market. But that's only, I think, about 8% of bank funding. No, it's only 2 or 3, I think. It's quite small. Then 8% of bank funding is covered bonds. They might buy a few of those. And those are secured bonds against, particular mortgage assets.
But again, keep in mind, these are we've got this. If you've got that, if you consider that Australia's got a debt bubble and we've got these really high housing prices, then these are measures that are basically saying
facilitating more debt.
Can we get more debt into this system? this will fix the problem. Yeah. We just need and that's part of the whole Morrison's 95. First home buyers can borrow 95%. Is basically that. He's basically saying we need more debt in this system. Everyone's all loaded up. Oh, this guy hasn't even got a home loan. How can we load him up with as much as possible?
A really important point in that is most other economies that have done this have done so after deleveraging, or at least during it.
Yeah.
And so they're actually turning around a reduction in debt rather than trying to boost it up from record highs. So it will be very difficult to do this. But anyway, they'll no doubt try. And then the other a large set of bonds that they could buy for the banks is unsecured debt. That's wholesale bonds. And if they bought all of those, it's about 40% of the bank funding costs. So they could drive down the bank funding costs a little. But then you've got the question of whether or not the banks actually pass that on through their mortgage rates, because there's no actual trigger for a rate cut to hold them to account.
But also at the same time, under that scenario, you're expecting that there's going to be a lot more bad debts on the existing loan book. And so partly what the RBA is doing at that point is basically saying to banks, look, here's some more money for you. We'll lower your funding costs so that you can make a bigger profit, so you can actually offset all those losses you're making on existing properties. And so a lot of that, we've seen internationally, that's basically a lot of what governments are trying to do really is saying, can we keep these banks alive enough and give them enough profit that, they can actually they can stay alive and bring the system down,
stay
and
solvent.
They can also keep lending to
extend and pretend.
Extend and pretend.
Not stay solvent, just stay liquid.
And so any we're foreseeing any opportunity for the RBA to pull an Arnie and start screaming to get to the chopper, or?
Well, I mean that's the next step is that you go. I should just say they probably would also buy government bonds, maybe corporate bonds as well.
Right.
But those aren't going to do a great deal either. They'll just keep funding costs down for sort of broader corporates, and in this any scenario in which this is transpiring, I expect government bond yields will be so low anyway that the RBA will be pushing on a string
We're already there. Like we're 50, you can borrow 15 years at 1.5% now for the Australian government. So if you're turning around saying, look, the Australian government won't lend stuff for 15 years and go and build infrastructure with it at 1.5%, but mate, if we can get that down to 1, mate, those guys are going to go nuts. It's like saying no.
Yeah,
they're not doing it now.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, will it work? look, they can drive down bank funding costs a little more and keep them, a little more in clover. They will probably succeed in driving up equity prices, which is what's transpired overseas. It's enough probably to keep the housing market just kind of, plodding along through this swamp, but it probably comes back to the Australian dollar. How much do these various undertakings actually sink the Australian dollar, so you get some real offshore demand to offset all this domestic weakness? That's quite a complex question. It will depend very much on the overall environment, but I mean, the RBA doing QE, you would expect, would sink the Australian dollar, all things being equal.
So it just leads into a question, actually. We've had it sitting here for a minute. I thought we'd wait till we got around to the dollar. But the question is, you'd love to hear about at what point, if any, the RBA would step in to protect the currency. And is that scenario a realistic one? So it's one of the RBA's pillars of strength, currency protection, or is that sort of a secondary effect?
No, I don't see a point at which they would step in at all.
Yep.
Basically,
they generally provide liquidity when it goes through sharp rises or sharp falls. They want to make sure there's enough liquidity out there that the fall is actually a genuine one, and it's not just caused by a couple of people trying to
one-sided market sort of thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, John Hempton had a really interesting anecdote on the Jolly Swagman recently when he was discussing a conversation he had with Guy DeBell, who's deputy governor now, when he was just an ordinary mortal. And he asked him, when would the RBA step in? And DeBell said, well, he said, would you step in at 40? No. 30? No. anywhere between 20 and 30. And he said, don't ask.
Right.
So they realised that the dollar would be the great stabilising force and would let it go.
And what we're getting to, though, is we want the dollar lower,
of course,
to fix a lot of the problems, to reinvigorate your manufacturing sector, and you can service more, and you might actually get wages, some Aussie dollar wage growth going at that point.
Yep, and it fixes the budget as well. It raises, has a hugely positive impact on commodity returns, all those things.
Your big issue is if we're in the current scenario, there's already a bit of an international battle to weaken your currency as much as possible.
Mm. We'd just be joining in on that.
We'll be joining in because we haven't really been playing that at all.
Yeah, sure.
But if this is any external crisis or trade wars, get worse, or global recessions or whatever it is ticks along, then we haven't been very good at playing that, and everyone else is pretty practiced at it. Mm. So there'll be lots of competition. Everyone's going to be trying to weaken their currency.
And so the next step, courtesy of our readers' question, would they leap to what is known as helicopter money, which would be to bypass all of this QE of buying bonds and various other market instruments, and actually just go to directly printing money for the government to spend on hopefully constructive stuff like infrastructure, but as we know in the Australian political economy, anything's possible.
Mm.
And we're actually quite supportive of the notion of helicopter money because it doesn't inflate asset prices and it does impact domestic demand. It hits the real economy. So it makes sense, makes much more sense when you've got, a massive debt bubble that you're trying to manage or indeed even deflate and get people deleveraging and support them through that, then helicopter money actually makes a hell of a lot more sense. What it also avoids is the kind of problems you've had with QE overseas where you inflate asset prices and wages stay weak and the real economy stays weak, and so you end up with these kind of class wars everywhere, and the rise of populism, etc., as the rich get richer through the asset prices and everyone else just, takes it for the team.
Just quickly on the topic of helicopter money, just a couple of examples. The first one that jumps to mind is Mr. Rudd's, what was it, the Kevin Rudd, Kevin 57, was it, 57-inch television sale at Kogan? Obviously, that's a short-term sugar hit version if you're just handing over $900 to a taxpayer. Is that the vein, or is it sort of something?
Well, that was just Keynesian fiscal stimulus. Mm-hmm. That was debt issued by they had a surplus at the time. So, in effect, they were raising debt and giving it to households.
Mm.
The difference with helicopter money is the RBA or the central bank is literally just creating the money out of nowhere, and there's no liability on it.
Right.
So you're literally just creating spending out of nothing.
And so the reason why they don't do that all the time is because if you do that, inflation gets out of control.
Venezuela.
But the issue is, if you've got no inflation and everywhere around the world is struggling with inflation, and we've seen the effect of QE hasn't been successful in terms of reflating these economies, and you pick any of the there's There's no major economy, and we've just seen the perfect time for this over the last 10 years. So what the RBA has the benefit of is we've just seen all these other countries try what works, and we've seen 20 years of Japan sitting there and trying all these different things, and so you'd like to think they've actually got their playbook right. If this happens to us, this is what we're going to do, and things are quite weak, and so here's our steps 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, but it does seem as if they're still, because they're all on the no, everything's fine. Yeah, we've had 4 years where we've missed our inflation target, but next year is coming good.
And yeah,
whereas now hopefully they're on the right path about getting out and looking, but we still haven't seen a lot of, as David said, they're quite a conservative organisation, and we haven't seen much on them in terms of saying if that happens here, here is what we're going to do, and we're ready for this, and we're going to get out and do it. So our concern is that, as David said, without a crisis to spur them on, we think in a crisis they would. A decent sized crisis that would actually spur them internal reflection and what are we going to do, and let's get out and make sure we're heading this all off at the pass. The issue is if we grind lower, given the way they've been acting for the last 4 or 5 years, is that it's just an incremental, well, let's try this. And as David said, stand back and wait for 3 months. Well, that didn't work as well as what we thought it did. Okay, let's try this next one. And keep in mind the last few things, and now try something else. And let's let APRA try and get some more debt out into the economy.
Helicopter money then. A former governor at the RBA, Warwick McKibben, has argued in favour of helicopter money over regular QE, but he's pretty much the only one in the country that has done so, other than Macro Business. So, the idea that the RBA would sensibly leapfrog QE and go to helicopter money is a bit of a stretch. It's much more likely to be incremental. Wait till there's enough of a crisis overseas when someone else does helicopter money, and then maybe experiment with it, in a few years' time when it's, kind of more acceptable to conventional thinking. And that actually means that you're going to miss out on one of the major benefits of helicopter money, and that is if you're first in, you'll sink your currency whilst you're boosting your domestic growth, which is a very unusual combination of factors. But I can't see the RBA jumping there before it goes through, the steps that we already know don't work.
Yep. Okay. All right. Very good. We'll jump across now to investment implications. I've got a question around bank shares, but we'll just kick off with the bond bull market.
Well, as Damo indicated, this is a raging phenomenon already today. The 15 years at 150 almost. If we get the 4 rate cuts, we could see the 10 down at 1%. And so there's a little bit more juice in the bond bull market, but a lot of it is already in. We're also seeing, kind of what transpires for equity markets, shares, when we get to this point where the central bank is pushing on a string and they're throwing money out in all sorts of new and interesting ways. When people can't get a decent yield out of fixed interest, then equities start to go up. And there's a technical calculation called the equity risk premium that means that, shares, because they've got a higher return on them, suddenly become more valuable than they were previously.
Yep.
And so that's really, I think, the phenomenon behind the current bank rally, where we know that they're still heading into quite troubled times. It's very unresolved about what their bad debts are going to be. Their net interest margins are really getting squished by all these rate cuts, et cetera, et cetera. So their earnings outlook is not very good, but they're on this absolute tear with their share prices because they're still pumping out these high dividends, which as the risk-free rate falls with bonds, those higher returns become more valuable. So I think that's what's behind the bank rally. And if it keeps going, so may the bank rally. But that's going to depend also very much on just how badly their earnings are hit as those bad loans start to flow in.
Okay.
The other thing here, probably key is the Australian dollar ought to keep falling simply because domestic demand in Australia shows no real prospect of any vigorous rebound. And the RBA will just be forced slowly but surely to go down this path of more and more easing. It's going to be competing with more and more central banks, but the prospect for the Aussie economy is just this sort of death of a thousand cuts as it tries to restructure away from its household debt bubble and towards external demand. And so, you know, the only way of getting there in the end is to dramatically increase your competitiveness and productivity and, you know, and actually start to you know, import less and export more over the long haul, which will be a structural adjustment, but basically the RBA exists in an ideology that doesn't see things that way. It thinks it can constantly kind of save things and they'll rebound using its little ruler. But, you know, that's the fundamental truth of it. So, yeah, the Australian dollar should still continue to fall over medium and long term. And then there's all various other factors in that with slowing China and commodity prices, etc.
Okay. Fantastic. Any notes on equities, Damien? Has there been? Do you think there's going to be and you were mentioning before the you know, a bit of upwards pressure from people, perhaps. And this is your typical SMSF investor, for example. You know, franking credits look like they're here to stay for a little bit longer. Term deposits are almost not even worth thinking about at the moment. Is that's just a natural support for equities? Is that sort of something that plays into what we're doing here, or is it a little bit too short term for the way that we think?
No, it's a bit short term. We had lots of cash, yep. Quite frankly. It's tough because both of them, like, we wind back sort of 6 months and we were very much onto this whole, look, let's push as much as we can into the bond market because bond yields are too high and they're going to come down, and they've come down far faster than what we expected. We were expecting, okay, we'll sit on that trade for a year or two and then we'll... And within 6 months, you know, we've gone from, we've sort of lopped a percent, more than a percent off some of these bond yields, which has been great in terms of returns. But now you're sitting at them saying, okay, well, how much lower can they go? Look, we think, yeah, they can go lower from 1.5. What's 10-year? 1.4. Probably head down closer to 1. But you know, it's starting to get hard. The risk return is no longer, you know, is no longer as stark as what it was, and the returns aren't. You know, aren't significant, and if you do get some unconventional monetary policy breakout somewhere, say in the US, is probably the most likely one, or somewhere else where they do start this helicopter money, and all of a sudden the RBA turns around and says, yeah, we might do some of that as well. You might see the bond market run away from you. You know, so it's not, we don't think that's imminent, but it's a risk if you're buying bonds at these levels. You need to keep an eye on. So I guess what I'm saying is the bonds we're still overweight. But we've just been winding that overweight back and winding it back and winding it back. And, yeah, it's harder and harder to justify sort of being in that. Equities, especially Australian equities, have run up significantly on a worsening outlook. So I guess it's part of it's been a sort of a relief rally in terms of we didn't get a Labor government. And so, you know, there's much greater chance of a housing crash with the Labor government changing rules around negative gearing and things like that.
Yep.
So it's been this great relief rally, but it's sort of saying, well, you still need to take a step back and say, should the Australian market be trading to a 10% premium to global markets? And even worse than that, the Australian market is highly dominated by both banks and resources, which are traditionally quite low PE sectors. So if you break up the sectors and look at the individual sectors and say, let me compare each individual Australian sector with its international comparison, every Australian sector is more expensive than its international competitor. And in most cases, they're actually more expensive than the US, which is the one economy that is actually growing.
Yeah, sure.
And so, so we still find it very difficult to buy Australian equities in any meaningful amount. We've got some, but it's very hard to come up with a reason for that Australian equity is going to outperform globally, especially with a view on the Aussie dollar in the longer term. Shorter term, there's other issues that keep it higher, but yeah.
Okay, and just quickly on staying on the banks, but we've obviously seen some hits to things like dividends, Given probably, you know, fallout of the Royal Commission, if anything, bit of restructuring, all the rest of it, just for those. And there's just a question here on bank share prices, but rather than trying to get you to pick a number, I thought maybe we'd just colour in a little bit around the thinking of the banks going forward. Is it, you know, for those that are investing locally, they've obviously been on a bit of a run in the last, you know, few months, almost, well, probably most of this year, to be fair. Is that something that, you know, is it worthwhile?
Want to comment on?
Yeah.
Look, I think the key thing to remember with the Aussie banks is that they haven't seen a downturn since the early 90s in terms of a significant, you know, recession in the Australian market.
Yep.
So if you're looking back and saying, well, what happened to them in, you know, the 1990s, in the 2007 post-financial crisis, and what happened in a few of these other markets, and you run through and look at, you know, what did bad debts do and all that type of stuff, you're really taking a quite a minor downturn and using that to try and judge what's gonna happen with the banks.
Yep.
So Australian banks still look relative to their international counterparts, they are now extremely expensive. They also earn much higher returns on equity than most other banks around the world. And so the question is saying, okay, well, if those are those returns on equity sustainable?
Mm.
If you get a housing shock, especially if you get an international, you know, trade war, global recession, or something like that has an external shock on the Australian economy, then you've got the RBA. Like, we've got the RBA doing all this stuff without an external shock. So if you get an external shock, it's, you know, the banks are in quite dire circumstances, and so now it's a question about saying, okay, if my base case is that everything's fine and I think there's no chance of a global shock, and I think that the housing is all contained, then the banks are all right at current levels.
Yep.
But if into your model you put anything that says, okay, well, they can have a similar downturn to what you saw in any one of dozens of countries, even just what happened to Australia in 1990, the last time we had a serious downturn.
Yep.
You know, if you put any of that into it, then banks at these levels don't look very attractive.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thanks, gentlemen. Okay, we'll roll into what's coming up next week. So, Thursday, the 20th of June, same bat time, same bat channel, the Nucleus Wealth live webinar page. The topic at the moment, working title, is Oils Ain't Oils, covering off on what's been a fairly rocky road for the oil price. It's fallen off some highs recently, and it's now testing its 2018 lows from the look of things. So, we'll cover off on that next week. Stay tuned. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.